From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The pandemic demanded huge adaptations from New Hampshire restaurants who responded with creativity and innovation. Still, it's been tough, and it could get tougher as outdoor dining goes away and community spread of COVID makes some customers nervous to go out to eat. But many restaurant owners say they're here to stay and can do so with support from patrons and elected officials. This hour on The Exchange, we hear the experiences of three restaurant owners in Portsmouth, Milford, and Gorham. But we're going to begin with Mike Summers, president and CEO of the New Hampshire Lodging and Restaurant Association. And Mike, thank you very much for being on The Exchange. Good to have you back.
Good morning, Laura. Thank you.
So you've said that restaurants have had a tough time planning with so much changing so quickly. You've said they're always just putting out the fire right in front of them. That makes sense. Still, Mike, what is the range of plans that you hear being made by restaurants as winter approaches? What's the conversation?
Well, it's a very broad and ranging conversation, as I'm sure you can imagine. And it's interesting that your guests are from such geographically diverse locations across the state, because I think depending on where you are in the state and kind of the environment you find yourself really is dictating how a lot of this planning is taking place. So, you know, we've heard some creative stories about folks making a run at continuing with outdoor dining throughout the winter, creating the quote-unquote ski village type of a scenario. Frankly, I'm not sure how successful that will be, simply because, you know, when it's in the teens and the wind's blowing, I'm not sure how you can possibly warm people up enough to make it tolerable. But that aside, I think a lot of businesses are planning for things with, you know, installing the barriers that were approved by the state a number of weeks ago, you know, working on making sure that their staffs are following the guidelines to the letter, you know, working on their HVAC systems, make sure that they're continuing to, you know, purge the buildings of air every, you know, 8 to 12 minutes and those kinds of things. So a lot of planning going on, but, you know, the real wrinkle in all of this is, you know, what's going to happen next? You know, what's the next shoe to drop? And so there are certainly a lot of challenges, and it's very much a moving target on the best of days.
Wow. Well, we hear nationally, Mike, 1 in 6 restaurants have closed since March. What's the ripple effect of a restaurant closure? And how worried are you that New Hampshire could find itself in the same boat?
Well, so I think we're doing a little better than the national average. I think that, you know, the governor and the state have been very proactive, and we've eased restrictions, you know, much more quickly than a lot of other areas. And there was also the regional recognition that, you know, northern counties could be, you know, a lot more flexible versus some southern counties. So I think those kinds of things have we're in a much better position in New Hampshire, frankly, than I think a lot of other states are. But to your question about what the ripple effects are, they're pretty significant. I mean, you know, the restaurant and hotel industry in New Hampshire is a significant part of the state economy. And so when we lose a restaurant or two or three in any given community, it affects a bunch of things. It affects, you know, livelihoods of the families that work in these businesses. It affects the contributions that these businesses make to their communities, whether it's through, you know, donations of gift certificates or time or food or whatever it might be. I mean, how many of us know a restaurant that supports the local Little League or whatever it might be? So those ripple effects, you know, spiral out pretty dramatically. And, you know, as a restaurant closes, you've got the employees of not only the restaurant, but the employees of the food vendors and the beverage vendors and all the other pieces that go into a restaurant. And so it has a pretty significant impact on local communities.
In addition to the state and local taxes, right, that restaurants provide. So what does the New Hampshire Restaurant Association, Mike, want from Congress? I know you're watching the debate over economic relief very closely.
Very closely. And what we're looking for, frankly, is going to be kind of a mix. I think we need, for our industry just to legitimately have a chance of survival until next spring, we need another package similar to what we had before that has some version of a PPP program, and which also includes some CARES Act funds that could potentially be, and we're not really too concerned about how it happens. It could be done through the state or direct grant programs, however they want to structure it. But I think the real key is We're going to need help to maintain our employee bases because business will likely be soft throughout this winter. And we're going to need support just to keep the lights on, the rent paid, and the rest of the machine working. And so, you know, whether that's, you know, Main Street Relief Grants was the example that we have had thus far. But we're going to need all of that as we look to get through the next 3, 4, 5 months. And so those are the real key components. And it will be interesting, obviously, as the discussion moves forward of what will ultimately be finally crafted.
Yeah. What about patrons, Mike? Sort of what's your message to New Hampshire restaurant patrons, whether they're ordering takeout or going into the restaurant?
Well, first, I think we want to thank them for their support throughout all of this. Certainly been a challenging year for all of the restaurants. But I think the important message that I would like to share with them is, you know, we've been, the restaurant industry has very much been positioned as, you know, kind of the cause of a lot of issues. And frankly, I don't think any of the data really supports that. Yes, there have been some instances, no doubt. We've certainly seen those. But frankly, they have been few and far between in the grand scheme of things, one. And two, I think that, you know, I hesitate to make the case, but I would make the case that you're probably safer dining in a restaurant in such a heavily regulated environment where, you know, all the staff has to wear masks, social distancing is required, sanitation takes place constantly, where the air systems in these restaurants with the, again, if anyone is familiar with the commercial hood system, you know, they have to replace the air in those buildings every 8 to 12 minutes. And that's really driven by the kitchen hood system because they're venting so much air, they have to bring in fresh air from outside. So, and that is completely unlike any scenario you have in a private home, you know, or office building or a grocery store, et cetera. So in a lot of ways, I would say the restaurant space is probably safer for, you know, a gathering with close family than likely many other instances. So just make that case.
Oh, that's interesting. So that's partly what prompted restaurants, right, Mike, to ask if they could have customer names and numbers to do their own contact tracing rather than having this sort of news media blast of, you know, restaurant A had a case of COVID.
That's right. And because really what was happening is, first and foremost, we were seeing that the individual restaurant that had the issue, and, you know, God forbid anyone has an issue, but when they were having the issue, it was damaging the brand of that restaurant clearly because of just a broad media pickup of those announcements. But more importantly, it was creating this impression that the restaurant industry wasn't safe. And frankly, if you take a look at the actual data that we've seen, you know, very few of these cases have really come in restaurants. There's really only been a small number compared to the total number of restaurants that are in New Hampshire. And so we just want to make sure that, you know, consumers understand that it really is not, it really is safe to come into these restaurants. And again, it's a result of all of the guidelines and rules and regulations that we are following that have come from the state and have been approved by health officials. So, you know, it certainly created a lot of challenges, but that was really why we kind of conceded to the contact tracing. And again, I think it also allows the state, as it does its contact tracing work, to be much more surgical. So instead of having this kind of a broad shotgun blast approach where, you know, if you were at this restaurant any of these 3 days, you know, you should quarantine, et cetera, you could wrap up, you know, 1,000 people in that announcement. Whereas if you're legitimately surgical and you know that it was one guest sat at one table and you can contact the four tables that sat around them or whatever the number is, you're really getting to the folks that it matters rather than just having this broad announcement. You may miss people in that effort anyway.
What's the role of your association, Mike, in all this?
Well, I think we're trying to lead through, obviously, carrying the message to our congressional delegation. We were on a phone call with Senator Shaheen on Friday, and she's been amazing through all of this. We're essentially become subject matter experts on all of the guidelines, the issues, et cetera. I didn't mention, but I also sit on the governor's reopen task force, so very much involved in all of these discussions. But again, trying to help these restaurants navigate all of the challenges, whether it's, you know, how does the Families First Coronavirus Act affect my restaurant? What do I do if an incident does happen? How do I, you know, comply with the universal guidelines, the restaurant guidelines, the event guidelines? How do those intersect with the various business models that we have in the state? So that's really where we've been most active throughout the course of this.
Well, Mike, it's good to talk to you. We really appreciate your time. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Laura.
That's Mike Summers, president and CEO of the New Hampshire Lodging and Restaurant Association. And listeners, we'd really like to hear from you. If you work in this industry, what has this year been like for you? How have you adapted? What are you thinking about for the winter? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. You can comment on Facebook. You can tweet us. And our phone number is 800-892-6477. Our guests for the rest of the hour are Liz Jackson, co-owner of Salt Pub and Libby's Bistro in Gorham, Nimi Idnani, proprietor of Raleigh Wine Bar and Eatery in Portsmouth, and Chris Vio, chef, owner of two restaurants, Greenleaf and Culture in Milford. And welcome to all of you. And even in the best of times, you don't need me to tell you this, the restaurant industry can be tough, it can be unpredictable. Mike Summers has said that this year has been a roller coaster for you guys. And I want to start by asking you, what draws you to this industry, even with all the challenges? And Liz, I'm going to start with you. You've been in the restaurant business for many years in Gorham. What makes you stay?
Oh, what makes me stay? Because I love it. Because when you have it in your blood to cook for people and entertain people, you can't get that out. And so either you're a restaurant person or you're not. So... So here we are, you know, with yet another challenge, but we're kind of wired for challenge in this business. And so here we go.
Chris, how about you? Your Milford restaurants are relatively new, but you've been in this business for a long time as well. What keeps you going, even when it's difficult, as we've seen this year?
It's really the community. I mean, we've been going through these times now since back in February, really, when things really started to trickle down. And yeah, to see that the community is still being very well supportive, it kind of pushes and motivates me to think creatively of how I can keep my staff involved and how we can come up with new solutions to help everybody continue to feel safe with coming out and dining with us, as we know that we are a monument for kind of the community around and supporting the local community by sourcing from farms. So we have to do everything that we can to maintain operations for ourselves and for the community around.
Well, and we'll talk this hour about all the flexibility that you guys have had to show with your menus, with your seating, with your hours, with the way that you do things. Nimi, how about you? What pulls you to this work? What's rewarding for you about it? Even though, you know, even in the best of times, it can be tough.
Yeah, I would say it's definitely our guests, seeing the same guests come back in and new guests, just be so happy to be having a good experience, enjoying the food and the atmosphere. That's just what draws me to this industry and wants us to be creative, to stay open and keep seeing those people come back in.
Kind of like hosting a really good dinner party every night, Nimi, I'm guessing.
Yeah,
you could probably all
feel that way.
Yeah, you could probably all relate to what Mike Summers said about just how difficult it is to plan in these times. As he so aptly put it, you know, it's like stomping out the fire right in front of you. It's hard to look ahead. But I am curious, Nimi, you first, what kind of plans are you at least thinking about for the cold season, Nimi?
Yeah, we're not 100% sure which way regulations are going to go, but on our end, we're planning to have a heavier takeout program and have a bunch of events that can be socially distanced. It feels like that's what people are looking for, to have something to look forward to. Recently, we've started doing some socially distant wine classes that have been going really well, and it's really nice to see people make the reservations for them, seem super excited about it when they come in. I think it's just having things to look forward to.
So a heavier takeout program and events that can be done socially distant. You mentioned the wine. What else, Nimi? That's really interesting, actually. You know, small sort of exclusive events where people could come and be spread out.
Yeah, we're trying to cap our events. All our events are capped at 20, but some of them are even capped at 14. So people can really be at different parts of the restaurant, but still feel like they're participating in a fun event and something that people are doing for their birthdays or anniversaries.
Oh, I see. Okay. And just to let listeners know, Nimi, how big is your place? I have to admit, I have not been there yet. So just give us a sense of how many tables and how many people you would normally
seat.
Yeah,
so typically we seat 49 people inside. With the social distancing, we're maxed at 23. And that's with every table at full capacity.
Wow, that's basically almost a cut in half. And Liz, I'm interested in your plans for the winter, recognizing what Nimi said, it's hard to make plans. You created a whole new outdoor dining experience this summer, out on the patio, lights, separate tents, and so forth. What's your thinking now, Liz? It's cold everywhere, but especially in Gorm.
It's super cold. Well, we did decide really fast after we had dinner with friends at 27 degrees a couple weeks ago with our heaters that the food just couldn't stay cold. And so we decided that that was not a good idea. But we did decorate the whole yard with beautiful Christmas lights. And what we're going to try to do is like reinvent a little bit outside for the winter with a walk-up bar to one of our porches that's inside, and just lovely warm drinks and lights and fires and heaters, and just an opportunity maybe for some après skiing or just to stop by and meet a friend for something warm and comforting and then go on your way, maybe grab some takeout from us and then go home. We thought it was also a fun and festive way to get takeout, so you could have a drink by a little fireplace and or under a heater and wait for your takeout and then go. We also ramped up this really fun kit thing that we've got going that you can take Libby's and Salt home with you or give it as a gift. And so it has all the components pretty much all ready to go for you to cook with your friends and family over the holidays.
So heat and eat, basically.
That goes well.
Heat and eat, basically. So they get your cooking, but they heat it up at home. So it's
maybe there's a few things that you do. And so we're also adding in our local farms to these kits. So carrots from Meadowstone and eggs from Middle Intervale Farm and potatoes and cranberries from a local cranberry store in the sauce.
So that's interesting,
so
Liz.
Trying to incorporate all of who we already work with and what can we do and how do we fit in to the community and what can we do to give you comfort that you can't have when you're dining in a restaurant over the holidays.
Well, that's interesting. And I've got this picture then, instead of just swinging by and picking up the, you know, the takeout, you're building some fires. People can, you know, gather and have a hot drink outside with a friend and then bring the food home. So
exactly. And then we have a little shop next door that we're ramping up a little bit more. So we're just trying to think of whatever ways we can for you to have the food or give the food as a gift without without dining in. Although
Chris, I want to bring you in too. You've got two restaurants in Milford, as I said, one that I think you just opened up this summer. How are you talking with your team about the upcoming winter?
It's difficult kind of having those conversations, but it's the inevitable. And experiencing it back in March, it kind of gave us some foresight into how we can better prepare ourselves for the winter if another closure is to happen. And just making the staff feel comfortable and knowing that I'm doing all that I can to make sure that they're still employed. And before it gets to those drastic measures, we're trying to kind of put systems in place to know that these are the kind of steps that we're going to be taking if that closure does occur. And what can we do to continue operations and continue to keep hopefully the majority of our staff employed throughout the winter season. Mm-hmm. So we're taking a look at things, definitely leading heavy into the takeout options and even thinking about doing specialty takeout Tuesdays where we have like featured dinners that you can prepare at home. And I'm going to be preparing like video tutorials of taking our ingredients that are pretty much are fully cooked for you and how you can plate them in your own interactive way at home and kind of get you and your family involved in the essence of the perfectly crafted plate, which is what we focus on at Greenleaf. And culture itself, which has just opened up back in August, it has been a trip for sure. I mean, to see the community support coming out there, within the first day we sold out of all of our items and we had to close down the next day to be able to kind of restock and revamp. So the need is still there for the restaurants to continue to maintain their operations so the community can feel that sense of home and that sense of involvement and support for the restaurants and the farms alike.
Wow, video tutorials. That's a good idea. I have two young adults in my life, a teenager and a 20-something, and both of them love watching those video tutorials, Chris, on TikTok or YouTube, and they've made some pretty good meals from it. So that's a good idea. When is that going to get started?
Looking at launching that in December.
Okay. just in time for Christmas. All of you, we're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we will talk about some of the new rules that you guys are having to follow, how that's been for you, how much money it might have cost. Also, as Mike Summers addressed, what help you'd like to see from Congress. And I'd like to know a little bit more about how you are retooling your takeout menus. I know that's not as easy as it sounds. We will also start taking phone calls and emails. So join us at 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org.
I love all parts of NHPR.
As an NHPR underwriter, you can connect to a news service that is personally important to people across New Hampshire.
Something that connects me to my community, to my state, and it's an important part of my daily life.
And NHPR listeners support businesses that support their station.
We feel that NHPR is sort of part of our family. It's just part of our community.
To learn more about how to speak to NHPR's loyal, community-minded audience, go to nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, New Hampshire restaurants on the innovations and adaptations they've had to make over the past 8 months and how they're viewing the approach of winter. And listeners, join us. If you work in this field, how has this year been for you? Or send us your questions and comments just to someone who likes to go out to eat. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We've been talking with Liz Jackson, co-owner of Salt Pub and Libby's Bistro in Gorham, Nimi Idnani, proprietor of Raleigh Wine Bar and Eatery in Portsmouth, and Chris Vio, chef owner of two restaurants, Greenleaf and Culture in Milford. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, I want to kick off this segment with an email that I got this morning from Kathy of Polly's Pancake Parlor, which I'm sure all of you know, an iconic place in the White Mountains. Kathy says, we opened back up on June 18th, 2 days after the governor allowed inside dining again. Our biggest frustration is the lack of flexibility with not being able to move tables for different party sizes. Our staff have been rock stars with the perpetual sanitizing. I wish I could say that all of the customers have acted the same way as our employees. But alas, Kathy says, that has been one of the most difficult parts. Some customers' sense of entitlement has been appalling. We have offered face masks to those who enter without, only to have some of them thrown back at my staff and the customer stomping out. My staff is fantastic, but battle-weary, as we are always on edge and nervous. I do have that gnawing sense of impending doom and feel like the noose is tightening ever so slightly every day. And wow, Kathy, thank you so much for writing. And I did want to ask all of you about some of the requirements that have been put in place. The Attorney General's office just this week fined half a dozen restaurants for violating COVID safety-related measures regarding masks. Chris, you first, please just outline some of the new rules that you have to follow in this environment, because people may not be clear what's required of them.
Right. So ever since we knew about the reopening and everything and we started bringing our staff on board, we wanted to make sure that we were feeling as comfortable as we possibly could with working in that environment. And as Mike had mentioned about the commercial hoods that do help with the intake and outtake of the air that's coming in. So we know that fresh air is always being breathed in through the building and the HVAC is doing its work to be able to provide that air for us. But beyond that, we've secured the necessary face masks that we need to kind of wear throughout the course of the day while prepping and while going through service to make sure that our staff feels safe and the guests kind of have that same security, knowing that we're doing that what we can in regards to PPE. We're constantly on a schedule of sanitizing the consistently touched surfaces that people come in and enter the building. We have sanitizer stations all throughout, and we're just staying closely guarded in the new regulations that are coming out and kind of dealing with the new mandates that are set by the state, whether it be asking for the guest information so we can work with the traceability and submit that information if any cases do outbreak.
Yeah, and Chris, what's been customer reaction to that relatively new rule that customers need to sign in when they dine in for easier contact tracing? Have people been pretty good about that?
For the most part, everyone has been really receptive. I know even with the mandate, we would have to reject any of those who did not want to cooperate. And it was more so just like an educational purpose, letting them know that this is the reason why we're doing it, just to make sure that there's traceability. And if anything were to come in effect, these are the steps and measures that the state is taking to make you feel more safe.
Nimi, can you also explain to your customers what you are having to do these days, just so people understand, you know, why some of the protocols might be different from before?
Yeah, I mean, it was similar to what Chris was saying, but our staff is, you know, constantly have masks on. We're sanitizing after every 15 to 30 minutes on high touch surfaces and definitely between guests at tables and, you know, starting with the contact tracing. You know, we've had, I'd say for the most part, people have been really good. We have had a few guests here and there who have been a bit upset about either having to wear a mask, give their name or phone number. But for the most part, I think people have been understanding.
Yeah, how do you deal with that, Nimi, when someone says, I don't want to do that?
You know, we just try to explain why we're doing it. And if they're not being cooperative, we just allow them to leave. It's been tough, but I always want to protect our staff, and there's no reason for them to be yelled at.
Absolutely. Liz, how hard are these rules to follow, either from a customer or staff standpoint? Also in terms of cost, Liz, how much have some of these new rules cost you?
Well, the cost is crazy. So just to buy the sanitizer, and actually I think I can buy like really nice whiskey for the same price as the sanitizer. But you know what? It's part of it, and it's what we have to do. As far as, is this difficult for customers? I don't think so. I mean, if they want to make it difficult for themselves by wearing a mask to their table, and I guess that's their choice, but it doesn't seem to be difficult at all for the customers. For us, the most important thing is the space between tables. And that's where, like, the minimum of 6 feet, I think we feel comfortable with a little bit more than that. And that's where the cost is coming in, because it's really minimizing in our restaurant, which has very small rooms. It's minimizing our table space. So.
Yeah, I'm sure you can relate to what the person who wrote from Polly's Pancake House about how a party comes in, it's a big party. And in the old days, right, Liz, you could just say, oh, okay, and cobble together a couple tables and voila. Now you can't really do that anymore, can you?
No, you can't. And actually, there are no tables larger than six. And that does frustrate some customers that they have to sit at different tables. But I would say that 99% of the people have been really positive and really thankful that we as restaurants are doing our part in making them safe to be out.
Oh. Well, here's a note from Maura on Facebook who says, I think the 6 foot spacing, plexiglass, contact tracing at restaurants is useless. Maura says, we see restaurants shamed because someone listed it on their contact tracing. But Maura says, I've seen no evidence that people catch it when dining out. Rather, she says, I see in-home gatherings as the culprit, working in close quarters, and sadly it spreads in captive places like nursing homes. Restaurants are unfairly blamed, and that brings up a theme that we talked about earlier with Mike Summers. Here's another email from Michael who says, I was wondering the thought process on using outdoor covered tents I've seen patrons eating in at restaurants. It makes me think that it's not as safe to eat inside the restaurant, but it's safe to eat inside a tent outside the restaurant. Michael says, just a little confused and hope your guests could provide some insights on the decision to use an outdoor covered tent. So we've all seen those pictures, you know, from New York City where they have these bubble tents that people are going into so they can eat outside. Nimi, is anybody, you yourself or anybody in Portsmouth, using these covered outside tents to try to keep people outside during the winter?
We are not. I believe there is one restaurant in Portsmouth that has tried it, but for the most part, we haven't seen that much in Portsmouth.
Yeah. And I wonder if you can sort of join his confusion over, is it safer inside? Is it safer in a tent outside? Yeah, go ahead.
I just actually recently read a study where it's the person concluded that it was definitely not safer to be outside in a tent. I mean, you're not getting, especially the bigger tents, which I know have been popular in places like New Jersey, where they basically just set up a full tent outside and you're actually, there's not makeup air being pumped in, and it's much worse than being inside the restaurant.
Well, thank you to those people for writing. And let's go to the phones. And Tom is calling in from Bedford. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. Welcome. Go ahead.
Yes. Hello. Good morning. It's Tom Boucher. I'm the CEO with Great New Hampshire Restaurants, which is...
Hi. Welcome back, Tom.
DJ's,
yeah, great.
Copper Door. Yeah. So I just want to comment on a couple of things that some of your guests have been speaking on and share some of our experiences. Similar to the Polly's Pancake caller, there are some guests that are just so... they just understand exactly what the rules are and how we're trying to navigate this. And I guess I would ask the public that's listening to just really have some empathy for the staff. You know, we're all going through an incredible time that our staff just is doing the very best they can. Secondly, I know that there's been a lot of comments, and I think that the public, again, needs to be a little bit more informed about how restaurants operate and how their margins are very slim. Although takeout is obviously an option and delivery, sit-down casual restaurants will not survive on takeout and delivery alone. They just won't. It's not the formula that works. Most people don't realize that third-party delivery services take 30%, between 25 and 30% of the revenue. Most restaurants make between 5 and 10%. So you're actually losing money by using a third-party delivery service. And I'm not trying to paint a bad picture here. I'm just trying to really give people a better sense of exactly what we're dealing with here. Restaurants that are down 30, 40, 50% will not survive this winter unless they've got a serious cash reserve. You will lose money at those revenue numbers being down that much. We anticipate our revenue to be down 30% for the winter, so we'll lose money all winter. We do have enough cash reserves. Many independents won't have the ability to. So we need another round of funding from Congress. That is the only way this industry is going to survive, not only just in New Hampshire, but across the country.
Well, and Tom, I have read that some restaurants, you know, used up that cash reserve if they had it in the spring. So it's even more dire this fall. I'm glad you called, though, because you mentioned something that I wanted to talk about, and that is delivery services like DoorDash or Grubhub. So Tom, you're saying you want people to realize that those services take a big bite out of restaurant profits, such as they are. And are you saying, Tom, you'd rather people not use them? They'd rather just do pickup?
It would be more advantageous for the restaurant, for sure. I mean, it's why we don't use them. We're actually starting to dip our toe in with Uber Eats. We were able to negotiate something that works a little bit better for that delivery model, but there's no way we would ever use Grubhub or DoorDash. You lose money. The numbers don't work.
Yeah. Last question for you, Tom. And again, I'm glad you called because, as you said, you own a couple restaurants in central and southern New Hampshire. The last time we talked in May, Tom, you told me you were starting to do sort of heat and eat, like pre-prepared, you know, macaroni and cheese or baked chicken and just to have
and
customers put it in the oven when they get home.
That,
how's that going?
That we started. It's called DingDongDeliver.com, and it's been really successful. And literally, when they drop off the cooler, they ring the doorbell and they deliver the freshly. It's either meals that are already prepared and ready to reheat, or it's meals that you cook yourself with instructions that we give, and it's delivered to the Bedford and Manchester communities. If you live in another community where our restaurants operate, say Salem or Laconia, Concord, we can deliver it to that restaurant and then you can pick it up there. It's been really successful. We have our own van, we have our own commissary that we do this out of. It's a concept known as ghost kitchens, which are really starting to be popular in the cities because it's putting a restaurant in a high visibility location, the rents are very expensive, whereas our commissary is in a very low rent location. In fact, we own the building, so it makes it even that more profitable. So it's been great. In fact, our Thanksgiving orders were up to almost $15,000, 150 orders that we're going to deliver the Wednesday before Thanksgiving.
Well, Tom, it's good to hear from you. Thank you for calling in, and good luck with the winter.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
All right, bye-bye. Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. All of you, could we talk a little bit more about takeout? And Chris, you first, but I want to hear from everybody. How much did you have to change your menus to accommodate takeout? Some dishes work and some dishes don't, I'm guessing.
That is correct. At Greenleaf, we focus on the intricate plating of the dishes and the thought process behind creating a thoughtfully provoking meal that entices all your senses. And when the first round of the closure happened, it was an immediate shock. And the first step for us to take was to kind of have a group meeting with the staff and let them know where everything stands. And from that point on, I shut the restaurant down for 2 days to be able to revamp and refocus the entire menu, as the meals that we were focusing on creating in the restaurant itself do not translate well to takeout. So I had to get a new product, communicate with the farms and see what they had available, talk to my vendors to see what takeout containers that are available, as everybody was shifting into takeout and there was a high demand, and
what those costs amount to.
And I'm just thinking about all those steps and places and seeing if this is something that would even be worth the change. And lucky enough for us, we went through that whole process and the community still wanted to come out and support us regardless of the type of food that we were serving, which completely changed over into more of comfort style meals, family style platters and things of that nature. And from that point on, we were able to kind of continue to build on that program until we were able to hit each and every phase along the way.
So give us an example, Chris, of something you had on your regular menu that just did not work. You had to replace it with something else.
Sure. One of our biggest selling specials would be the duck breast that we were bringing in from Elevage up in Loudoun. And we actually had to cut off that connection with that farm, as right when we were getting our next delivery of those ducks, the closure took place. And that farmer in particular only works with a selective group of chefs. And we all had that kind of same notion where we're screwed in this nature and we need to figure out how we can kind of figure out how we can cut costs somewhere to be able to get the containers in that we need to offer takeout and shift into food that would be more approachable for family style gatherings or food that would transfer over well. And thinking in terms of a duck where you're trying to serve it medium rare to medium, and then you're enclosing it into a container which is going to steam itself, which will carry the temperature up to medium well or well done. It just doesn't have that same effect, and you get not the same flavor and profile that you're looking for.
Okay, that is something that as a non-chef, I absolutely would not have thought of, but I can completely see where you're coming from. How about you, Nimi? What have you had to do to revamp that takeout menu?
Yeah, our food also didn't particularly translate very well to takeout. So when we decided to reopen in May after being shut for a month, our chef Jeremy Glover and I sat down and we came up with the idea of a supper club, and it was more kind of comfort meals. That was a 3-course meal that we offered, and that's probably something that we'll bring back for the winter. And they were meals that could be easily reheated and worked well for takeout.
Can you give us an example, Nimi, of what didn't work well for takeout? It was so interesting to hear the example from Chris about duck just has to be served a certain way, and once you put it in a container and it sits there, it's just not going to work. Can you give the sort of non-chef public an idea of what dish just absolutely does not work in takeout? Sorry, it's not on the takeout menu, but it just isn't going to be good.
Yeah, definitely. So we do a lot of fresh crudos and oysters, and none of that works well for takeout.
Yeah.
You can't keep it cold enough. It's going to get messy. It's not going to look pretty. And it's just something that won't work, unfortunately.
Well, coming up after break, I've got some more Facebook comments and emails I'd like to share with you. And also, I want to ask all of you what you want to hear from Congress. We talked earlier with Mike Summers about what he's hoping for from Congress in terms of an aid package to get restaurants through the winter. I'd like to hear from all of you on that as well. And we'll keep taking your calls too. It's 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us.
One of the first reasons we decided to be an underwriter with NHPR was because we were listeners ourselves.
Kate Morneau of Morneau Law is a proud NHPR underwriter.
Morneau Law's values are completely aligned with NHPR's values. We are focused on the community, giving back to the community, and it's really a natural fit.
You too can join our statewide community of local business supporters. Learn more at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how New Hampshire restaurants are doing and what they're thinking about as winter approaches. Listeners, join us with your questions and your stories. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And I want to ask all of you about how your employees are doing. And Liz Jackson, too, first, what about your staff at Libby's Bistro in Gorham? What kind of adjustments have you had to make there?
Well, we're pretty much keeping everyone working.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We had a couple of lucky things that happened where someone is getting ready to retire, so it was easy for her to step away a little bit. And we have a young chef who just got married, and he's moving on to a new adventure. So for this winter, like, we feel lucky that we don't really have to lay anyone off at this point, just because of these things that luckily happened. So our staff has a beautiful attitude, and the PPP came to us in the spring when it had to be used up quickly, not saved for now. But it provided this really beautiful moment of us all working together to paint the front of Atlas, our shop, a really bright, cheery color, and do some pottery together and for the restaurant, and just to make everyone tighter. And so I feel like I wish the money had gone somewhere else, like, for now, but it also added to this tightness in our group that I'm really happy that we had.
So, well, and I definitely want to ask all of you in a moment about your hopes for what you'll get from Congress, since you mentioned those payroll protection loans, Liz, for sure. But Nimi, how about you? What choices did you have to make around staffing at Raleigh Wine Bar and Eatery?
Yeah, it was really tough after the first closure. We tried to bring back all our staff that was close to full time, which we were able to do. We did not bring back our part time members, and we did also get lucky in that one of our chefs also wanted to take time off, as she just had a newborn. So it kind of worked out for us. We unfortunately couldn't bring back our part-timers, but almost all of our full-timers were able to come back.
Yeah, and Chris Vio, how about you at your two restaurants in Milford? What issues is your staff having in terms of coming back to work with schools closed? For example, we hear that some people are having childcare problems. Or have you also had to get rid of your part-timers, Chris?
With us, we have such a small staff that the PPP was essential to be able to bring those employees back on. So as we went through the testing phase of the first round of takeout, primarily it was myself and my general manager and one other that was helping with those orders, fulfilling those orders. And as we saw, the takeout was starting to kind of boom. It was within a matter of a week, 2 weeks, we were able to start bringing on more and more staff. And as the next phase came in, where we were able to do outdoor dining, then indoor dining, then we were able to allow our service staff to come in and really make sure that they felt comfortable with coming in, knowing that knowing the situation that we're all in, and really providing them the opportunity to say, yes, I would love the opportunity to continue to work. And it was interesting trying to figure out creative ways of battling the whole theory about the unemployment, where they would be making more money on unemployment than they would be as opposed to coming back and working, which we've heard from all of our staff that came back on, is that they would much rather work than sit at home and collect the unemployment and kind of take those benefits, which was heartwarming for us to hear, just knowing that we're doing that much of a tremendous job, that people would rather come in to work with us and help really enhance the vision that we're trying to create for the community in these COVID days. Bringing on our staff was essential to be able to kind of maintain operations, and having the support of the staff and knowing that they're coming in and putting themselves at risk I definitely wanted to make sure that they were feeling as comfortable as they possibly could, and they're able to come and communicate with me in any way and shape that they would like to see any changes or anything that we can do to make everybody feel at home.
Well, so Chris, you and Liz both mentioned the PPP, the Payroll Protection Program. How much, Chris, and I want to hear from everybody on this, but Chris, you first, how much were you helped by all the small business grants and loans and so forth that Congress passed this spring? Because I've heard sort of a lot of people say it was super helpful and other people give it mixed reviews.
It was really helpful. I mean, that was the decision maker between staying open or having to shut down and kind of wait out the spring, wait out the summer and see what would happen, if anything would happen.
Wow, that's pretty dramatic. Yeah, go ahead.
It really is. So being able to receive those funds and having that security of knowing that at least we can start continuing to bring in our product, we can continue to pay all our past owed bills, we can start bringing our staff back on, that allowed us the freedom to be able to move on through each phase and know that at least for these few months, we will be secure.
Wow. Nimi, how about you? How much were you helped by the loans and grants and so forth?
Yeah, I would say the same thing. It definitely got us through those months where, you know, we were only doing takeout. And then when we only had a couple of outside tables, it allowed us to have money to keep our staff on and then get through those months. Hopefully they have another round ready, because I'm not sure what's going to happen through the winter. I'm sure most of us have unfortunately burned through those funds over the spring and summer.
Yeah. Is there any way, Nimi, that they could craft it differently this time that would be even more helpful? We have heard some complaints that, you know, as good as the PPP was, you couldn't always access it in the way that would have been most beneficial.
Yeah, I think, you know, it would be great just to know upfront what truly is the timeline and what it can be used for, because that seemed to be a work in progress. And I know that some people thought that they had to use it all very fast, and others kind of held on to it. And some even didn't apply for it just because they were so concerned that it would just be another loan on the books. So I think just being clear up front that, you know, it is a grant and this is what it can be used for would be so helpful for everyone.
Sure. Liz, in your opinion, what was lacking in these aid packages? How could they have been more helpful and maybe will be the next time?
Well, I think the hard thing was initially we got in on the first round is that we had to spend it quickly. And so we used it at times when our employees could have been collecting unemployment when we were actually shut down. I said that it added something great to our work community, and it did. But if we don't get this other round, it's going to make it more difficult for us. So it would have been nice to know in the beginning, but I don't blame them because it was new to everyone, that we could have held on to the money for a little bit longer. But it was a game changer for us, though, and we're so grateful to have had it. So
here's a comment from Aaron on Facebook who says, I'm a brewery owner in Manchester. I know of several restaurants that are constantly violating the COVID restrictions. The local municipalities say they have no power to enforce the COVID restrictions, but the state does not seem to be enforcing these serial violators. Aaron says, it's frustrating to think we could have another shutdown because of these restaurants when we are doing everything recommended by the state. There needs to be more done to enforce the rules to keep everyone safe. And as all of you know, it was reported this week that the Attorney General's office has cited several restaurants and actually cited and fined a couple more. And there's a story about that on NHPR's website, NHPR.org. So, but I wonder what you think about that, Liz, that, you know, those who are violating the rules are giving the rest of you a bad name.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's something that we talk about at home in the morning over coffee, is that they're going to get us all shut down. And I know they're trying to survive and this is how they're doing it. But I do feel that we're all going to get hurt if we don't all go by the rules and take it seriously.
No. Here's an email. Oh, go ahead. Sorry, Liz.
Nope. That was just a...
Here's an email from Will who says, my wife and I recently went to a restaurant in North Conway and noticed that despite the tables being properly spaced, there were patrons at the bar sitting shoulder to shoulder and maskless. Will says, where is the logic in that? Nimi, I'm going to throw this one to you because, you know, Raleigh Wine Bar and Eatery, that implies to me that you have a bar. What are the rules around bars? That sounds complicated for you.
Yeah, so at our bar, we typically have, well, we have two bars, one which is completely closed because it's too close to the tables. And then the other one is 10 seats. And we basically just have two seats on one end and three seats on the other, in which only single parties can sit at. So there is more than 6 feet between one party and the next. And I think in Portsmouth, I've seen most of the restaurants are trying to comply with keeping the distancing with at the bar, although I'm sure there are some offenders as well.
Well, and when you see people maskless sitting shoulder to shoulder, as he writes, they could be from the same household. It could be me, you know, out with my family. But I appreciate him raising that point, because the whole restaurant versus bar thing has been a little bit complicated. I want to ask all of you one more question before we close out. And I think I'll start with you, Chris. You're running two restaurants, as I said, including one you opened in August in the middle of the pandemic. So I'm guessing you're an optimist, Chris. What's making you feel hopeful about your two places there in Milford and restaurants in general in New Hampshire?
I really have to kind of bring that down on the staff. The staff support and really wanting to come out and continue to kind of show that we are ingrained into the community and willing to do whatever it takes to remain open for the community. So our staff has been a huge monument to our success. In part and parcel with that is the community who has been coming out and supporting us and continuing the takeout if they don't feel comfortable with indoor dining. And it's just all those things that continue to amount to my hope for the future in this winter season, as we have just eliminated the outdoor dining, as we had that lucky stretch of the warm weather that carried us through a little bit in the beginning of November. But as we transfer completely into indoor dining, we just want our community to kind of keep in the back of our minds that we are resilient folk, the restaurant community, and we will continue to do whatever we can to provide comfort through food. And hopefully we can all kind of band together and make our way through this.
Yeah. And do you think you'll be able to keep both of your restaurants open, Chris?
I'm really hoping so. It was definitely a tough decision going for the call of opening the bakery in the middle of August during the pandemic. But yeah. I've been holding on to that space since last August. So there were definitely bills in play and decisions needed to be made. And as soon as I wrote in that first rent check, it was just the matter of making sure that I had all my numbers in order to see what COVID numbers would realistically look like and if this would be a sustainable business. And we've been fortunate enough to receive great feedback from the community around that has helped us be hopeful in continuing the operations. And hopefully with all the precautions and measures that we're taking and putting into place and us having the recall of what happened in March with our original round of closures, that'll give us the necessary foresight that we need to be able to know who we can keep on staff, what kind of food we can provide to the community, and what that will look like for us carrying us through December into, let's call it, April and May.
Yeah, and we'll see how it goes with some of the innovations that you guys are talking about in terms of different ways of, you know, takeout that maybe people have to prep a little bit by themselves, those tutorials that you talked about, Chris. Nimi, to you, what's the best thing that you've learned throughout all this crazy, crazy year for restaurants, whether about the business itself or your community or even yourself as an entrepreneur, Nimi?
Yeah, it's been amazing how resilient our staff has been. They're, you know, very willing to adapt with every new regulation and changes, and how much they were ready to come back even when, you know, some of them probably would have made more sitting at home and collecting unemployment when they were getting the extra 600. So that was really heartwarming to see. It's also been amazing the support that we've had both from the community, our guests, and the city itself, at least. I mean, the amount of times I've had city councilors check in to see what the city could be doing. It's just great to see the support that we've had from all sides.
Oh, that's interesting. And I think I read earlier this year, Nimi, that you were involved in a group of Portsmouth restaurants who kind of went to the city and said, you know, help us out. Here's what we need.
Yeah. And the city was really responsive. And since that initial reach out, I mean, they have been, I'd say, even individual city councilors checking in pretty much consistently to say, what else can we do to help you guys out?
Liz, you've been in this business for a long time. As restaurants look with some understandable concern to the winter, what advice do you have for your colleagues in this industry?
To keep your spending down as much as you can, and to just be as thoughtful as we can to our approach to food. I mean, at the end of the day, we're here to provide comfort and entertainment and just to feel a good feeling to our customers. And so to dig deep inside, I guess, to find out how do we fit into that equation in a different way than what's normal. So I guess, again, to be resilient and willing to take a chance with new ideas.
How do we serve that role in a different way? I think that kind of summarizes it in general and what I've heard from the three of you this hour. Well, best wishes for you this winter and getting through it. I really appreciate everybody being with us. Liz Jackson, thank you for your time. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
That's Liz Jackson, co-owner of Salt Pub and Libby's Bistro in Gorham. And Nimi Idnani, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That's Nimi Idnani, proprietor of Rally Wine Bar and Eatery in Portsmouth. And Chris Vio, thank you also for your time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the conversation.
That's Chris Vio, chef, owner of two restaurants, Greenleaf and Culture in Milford. Today's show was produced by Exchange fellow Jane Vaughn. I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.